So tonight we're going to be thinking about Huldrych Zwingli. He was born on the 1st of January, auspiciously beginning of the year, 1484, and he lived until the 11th of October, 1531. And I'm speaking on Zwingli because I feel a bit sorry for him. See, in the Reformation, there are two giants of the Reformation. There's Martin Luther with his extreme charismatic personality. In fact, so charismatic that he started a denomination. Martin Luther, Lutherans, he has a whole denomination named after him. And then the other sort of giant is John Calvin. He was a much more sort of introverted personality. He seems like quite a quiet person. But because of his sheer great intellect and all the many books, the hundreds of commentaries he wrote, his institutes, because of his intellect, he's a great towering giant. So when people think about the Reformation, it's Luther and it's Calvin. Or there's Tyndale. When David Williams spoke, there's Tyndale. And he was martyred for his faith. So also there's Protestant martyrs in this country. And because they're martyred, they're heroes too. But unfortunately, Zwingli died on the battlefield. He was fighting when he died. And so he neither lived long enough to write lots of books like Calvin, nor did he die a hero, a martyr like sort of Tyndale and others. And he didn't quite have the personality of Luther. So nobody's really interested in it. In fact, to prove the point, I wasn't at all surprised. When I asked various people in the church if they'd like to talk on these people, I offered all the names out and I said, I'll do whoever's left over. And before they replied, I started preparing Zwingli. Because I knew that nobody really cares. But I'm going to put a pitch in. I think he's probably one of the greatest reformers, but I'm biased. And I want to start with his end. So what we're going to find out is that when Zwingli fell out with Luther, or probably more likely the other way around, over the Lord's Supper, this left the Swiss Reformation Church with a very few allies. And politically, in October 1531, in a surprise move, the five Catholic states declared war on Zurich, where Zwingli was. Zurich's mobilization was slow due to internal squabbling. And on the 11th of October, 3,500 poorly deplored men encountered a five-states force nearly double their size at Capel. And many pastors, including Zwingli, were among the soldiers. The battle lasted less than an hour, and Zwingli was among the 500 casualties in the Zurich army. And that's a sad way to end, because Zwingli, throughout his life, considered himself first and foremost a soldier of Christ, second, a defender of his country and the Confederation, and thirdly, a leader of his city, Zurich. But ironically, when he died at the age of 47, he died not for Christ nor the Confederation, but he died for Zurich. And for that, as I've said already, there are many reasons why he's kind of the ugly duckling of the Reformation. But tonight I'm going to try and argue to you that I think he's the true father of the first Baptists. And it's his legacy that leads to the swan of the nonconformists. You see, many reformers in the UK, for example, they were led to become reformers because of reading Zwingli. When we do the English Reformation in about a month or so's time, you'll come across Bishop John Hooper. And he became a steward in the house of Sir Thomas Arundel. And it was in Sir Thomas Arundel's library that he read Zwingli. And that led him to the Reformation. Equally, we're going to learn about John Knox. You've probably heard of John Knox in Scotland. He arose in the 1540s as the sword bearer, literally a claymore sword, the sword bearer of a Zwinglian pastor, George Wishart. So even though he's in the background, I'm going to argue that I think Zwingli had a huge impact sort of behind the scenes in the Reformation. But anyway, so what's his life and what can we learn from it? First of all, he was born in 1484, just a few weeks after Martin Luther. So they're total contemporaries. Like Luther, he was born in a time of emerging nationalism. So don't think nation states. Germany and Switzerland, they're not, as Ian said last week, they're not nation states. Think more of sort of collections of people with the same ethnicity. They speak the same language. But they're increasingly becoming proud of their kind of tribe. As a boy, he spent time in the cities of Basel and city of Bern and attended the universities of Vienna and Basel. a scholarly centre for Renaissance humanism. So he's very well educated and he's a man of the city. He continued in studies where he served as a pastor in Glarus in Switzerland and later in Iserdeln, where he was influenced by the writings of Erasmus, the humanist. So Zwingli is a well-educated humanist, like most of the reformers apart from Luther. Zwingli was known as God's mercenary because at that time in history, the Swiss were the mercenaries of Europe. In fact, if you think about it, does anybody know there is a vestige of that that still exists today? Anybody know where we see that now in Europe?
Vatican.
Yeah, exactly. So the Swiss Guard at the Vatican, that's historically, because at this time in history, the Swiss were the mercenaries of Europe. Zwingli was not a fan of that. In fact, the first thing he wrote was a poem about called The Ox, which is about the way he hated the fact that the Swiss were just sort of used as a beast of burden all over Europe, with one exception. He wrote a letter, a piece of work, defending the one case it was okay for the Swiss to be mercenaries, was fighting for the church. And for that, he received a papal pension, so that's not quite bad. So the Pope, the Roman Catholic Church at the time, offered to pay him for life, if he wanted to, because he wrote defending. It was okay to be a mercenary as long as it was for the church. So as a priest in Glarus, he signed up as an army chaplain and he went off to fight for the Holy Father and Mother Church. And now, this was key in his development because his side, the battle he was fighting, was slaughtered. And his romantic patriotism and his naive trust in the Pope were pretty heavily shattered by that terrible thing. He was one of the few to come back alive. So when he returned to Glarus to be a priest, he was pretty sobered by what he'd seen on the battlefield. And it was there as a priest over those 10 years that he learnt Greek. He learnt the New Testament Greek. And it may seem strange to you, but it's pretty common at the time. He realised that as a priest, he'd spent all his time reading commentaries, but he'd get this straight, he'd never actually read the Bible at all yet. And he thought, well, I think I should do that. So in 1516, he bought a copy of Erasmus's Greek New Testament, hot off the press. And again, you've got to realise how sort of scary. This was a bit like Lady Chatterley's Lover, back then. This was to own a copy of this Greek New Testament hot off the press was pretty scary. Not other members of the society would be disapproving your reading. So you can almost imagine his sort of slightly risque excitement as he gets a New Testament and he reads it for himself. And that set off a journey for Zwingli. I want to be clear, as we were saying last time, we're not setting these men up as great heroes only. They're not alabaster saints. Like all the people of his time, they believed all sorts of things that we would find strange now. For example, when he ministered at Iserdeln is still to this day very famous for its Marian shrine, the Black Mary. And throughout his ministry, even as a reformer, he was very pro-Mary. In fact, he argued until he died for the doctrine of the perpetual virginity of Mary, which, don't ask me to explain how that's possible, but he did. So you've got to remember, this is someone who back then also is very pro-papacy, still very happy to receive his papal pension, believes all sorts of things that we would find strange, but is beginning to reform his thinking according to the Bible. And at that point, he's beginning to make a name for himself because someone asks him or starts to look into him beginning to move to the great minster, like the cathedral in Zurich in 1518. And there's a wonderful story that happens around that move that tells us a lot about the Reformation. It's a really interesting insight. Because while he moved, at the time there was a rumour, and we kind of presume it was put about by the Catholics who didn't like him, there was a rumour about Zwingli's chastity. There was a rumour going around that he got one of the daughters of the local town where he was pregnant. Now, to give a bit of an insight into the Reformation, this was quite common. Most of the Reformation went on like that on both sides. There were always pamphlets going around saying that this particular leader had done all sorts of things. So either it was the Protestants saying that the Catholics were corrupt, don't trust them, or it was the Catholics saying that the Protestants, oh, this is anarchy, it's social chaos. So they were both using it. So for lots of 100 years, nobody knew whether this was true or not. In fact, most historians assumed that it was just propaganda and it wasn't really true. Until, and this is when it gets really interesting, until a few hundred years later. A distinguished Zwingli scholar in Zurich, this is in the late 18th century, a guy called Johannes Schultes, he was going through documents with his assistant and he came across a book where a letter fell out. And because he was a Zwingli expert, he immediately recognized the handwriting. He was there with his student and he read this letter, and it was a letter from Zwingli writing to the church, the great minister, explaining what had really happened and confessing and saying, yeah, it's true, I did get this girl pregnant. However, you know, I've repented of that, that's in the past, and I reassure you that I've changed and that won't happen again. Now, what do you do? This is a fascinating bit of history. What do you do at that point? Schultes was then stuck. Schultes was a, you know, loves Zwingli. What do you do with this information? Up to this point, everyone assumes it's not true. So he put it into the candle of the flame to burn it. Because once this letter is gone, then the name of Zwingli would not be tarnished. But he hesitated and he pulled it out and extinguished the blew out the flame. And in a moment of, you know, one of those great, you want this to be in a film, don't you? Apparently, he turned to his assistant and suddenly stopped and said, Protestantism is the truth in all circumstances. And then they logged it. And you can find it now. Apparently, you can go to the library in Zurich, you find this letter, and it's a bit burned when he was starting to burn it. But it's a wonderful story, A, because it tells you a bit of the background. So this was going on all the time. There were claims and counterclaims, and we don't know whether it's true. But also, that's a great story about Zwingli, because although it was a few hundred years later, I think Schultes got it from Zwingli. That was what he was like. His desire for the Reformation was that it was the truth in all circumstances. That what the Bible says, we're going to just go for it. If it's uncomfortable, it's the truth. Anyway, so he gets appointed. And on the, so obviously they believed him, but, you know, he wasn't going to sleep around. And by the way, let's not be too harsh on Zwingli. In the same town where he ministered, there was another priest who'd had, I think, 6 children. So it wasn't exactly uncommon. Anyway, so he gets appointed 1st of January on his birthday, 35th birthday, 1519. He stepped into the pulpit of the great minster in Zurich and he announced, and again, this would be completely radical, that instead of doing the usual reading and quotations, he was going to do something completely novel. He was now in this minster, he was going to preach through Matthew's gospel verse by verse. And when he finished Matthew's gospel, he was just going to preach through the rest of the New Testament. And that was kind of programmatic for his method, because he was saying, in effect, this is how the city of Zurich is going to be reformed, patiently, just simply teaching the Bible, not doing anything massively radical, he didn't think, just simply teaching the Bible and letting God's word do its work. And that was his approach. Preach the word, let God do his work. He wasn't very confrontational, it's not like Luther. And therefore, some of the reformers in Zurich got quite frustrated. They wanted him to push harder ahead. But he argued, and this is a very kind of Baptistic way of thinking, that Christ rules the church through his word, not the Pope. That year, 1519, he hears of Luther's attack on papal authority, and he declares Luther is the new Elijah. See, at this time, they like each other. And that's why the papal pension is key, because lots of scholars argue about who came first. So initially, Zwingli is quite happy to be dependent on Luther. When they fall out, then he starts saying that he had all these ideas all along. And, you know, nobody's certain. But the fact that he only relinquishes his papal pension much later suggests that actually the reform was slower, and probably Martin Luther got there first. Between 1519 and then into early 1520, a key thing happened in his life, and that is, so he's in the great, like the cathedral, the great minster in Zurich, a plague comes along that wipes out 25% of the population. Now just think about that. Imagine you're in church, so we're there Sunday morning, this morning. Imagine that in the next couple of weeks, a quarter of the whole church is going to die through a plague. Just think about how that would affect you. And so because of that, probably the guiding motif of Zwingli is the sovereignty of God. If Luther's big question that he was wrestling with was, how can a holy, righteous God, you know, forgive me, how can I stand before a holy God? Zwingli's greatest question he was always wrestling with is, how can a sovereign God allow such suffering in the world? And he was always wrestling with that. In fact, he was on a mineral springs vacation in August 1519 when the Black Death broke out in Zurich. And although he was already weak from exhausting work, he immediately hurried back to Zurich to minister to victims. And before long, he himself caught the disease and was likely to perish. But his work not yet done, he recovered and he went back to helping people. And what we're not going to sing it, fortunately, but his most famous hymn that he wrote was in a response to this great plague. And when he recovered, so he wrote the first four verses when the disease first struck, the next four verses as his health deteriorated, and the final four verses when he got better. Just this, listen to this, because this gives you kind of a flavour of the person. Help me, O Lord, my strength and rock. Low at the door I hear death's knock. Uplift shine arm once pierced for me that conquered death and set me free. Yet if thy voice in life's midday recalls my soul, then I obey. In faith and hope earth I resign, secure of heaven, for I am thine. My pains increase, haste to console, for fear and woe seize body and soul. Death is at hand, my senses fail, my tongue is dumb, now Christ prevail. Lo, Satan strains to snatch his prey, I feel his grasp, must I give way? He harms me not, I fear no loss, for here I lie beneath thy cross. My God, my Lord, healed by thy hand, upon the earth once more I stand. Let sin no more rule over me, my mouth shall sing alone to thee. Though now delayed, my hour will come, involved perchance in deeper gloom. But let it come, with joy I'll rise, and bear my yoke straight to the skies. Gives you kind of a flavour of him wrestling with the Black Death. So then that's 1520, and as I say, in 1520 he renounces his papal pension. And as I say, that becomes a bit embarrassing for those who try to defend him in the debate, Luther and Zwingli, because as always, the Germans get there first. I've called this whole series Beer and Sausages. You'll have to wait for Karen to talk about Katie Luther to hear about the beer. But this is where we get to the sausages, because that's what I love. See, the German Reformation was quite boring. It was just a whole lot of theses nailed to a wall. But the Swiss Reformation started with sausages. This was Sausagegate in 1522. Because, of course, the background to this is that it's Lent, and as good Christians in Lent, in the Middle Ages, they're forbidden for eating meat during Lent. But one printer, Christoph Froschauer, breaks the Lenten fast by eating a sausage. And it's fascinating because this printer and his men, they eat a sausage. Apparently Zwingli was present, but he didn't actually eat any sausages, which does remind me a little bit of sort of Bill Clinton, that, you know, he had a joint, but he didn't actually inhale. So, but the point was that it was really, really significant that he's in effect the leader of this great church, and he is present condoning, that's the key thing, he's condoning it while they eat meat. Now, the key thing from Zwingli, why was he defending that, was he couldn't see any commands in the Bible that said you can't eat meat during Lent. Now, that's the key thing. He was not saying there's anything wrong with fasting. His problem was the church imposing things onto everyone and saying that you must fast. That was his problem. He couldn't see it in the Bible. So he was saying, well, if it's not in the Bible, what is the church doing imposing it? So he encouraged them. But that story is also really key because it gives some of us the context of the Reformation too, because at this time in history, you've got to remember that we are moving from a rural society to an urban society. So think about Martin Luther. He was much more rural. Although he studied in the cities, he grew up in rural areas. So in Martin Luther's world, you've got a rural calendar of seasons. Of course, Lent is a good time because you've sowed the crops. You're waiting for them to grow. You don't need to harvest them. So in a rural feudal system, Lent's a good time. You're not so bothered about people not eating meat because they don't have to work hard during Lent. In a city, it's very different. In a city, you've got a city with printers. Now, printers, this is urban production now. So printers, a printer wants his guys to work 6 days a week. So he wants them eating meat. He doesn't want them, you know, sort of lazing around. He wants productivity. So I'm not saying that that was entirely what drove the Reformation. I think Zwingli had biblical principles too. But it is interesting to notice how that sort of shift to the city is. You can see why printers would be all for, well, let's get our guys eating meat because I'm more industrialized. And also, it's no coincidence that it's printers. Printers always tend to be on the radical end of things. It's like people in IT today, if you're in information technology, I think you notice that people in IT, they tend to be libertarian. Whenever, if you watch it in the news, whenever the government threatens to have some kind of control of the internet, usually for good reasons, it's all the IT people say, no, we don't. We want freedom of information, because that in that kind of world, that's what you're into. So you've got young, edgy, new technology, printing. They're going to be more radical. And because it's in the city, that means that the Swiss Reformation is going to be much more radical than the German Reformation. They're going to want to smash things. And that's another thing. I think God used this. But you've got to realize that Reformation is attractive, particularly to young men with lots of energy who like smashing things. If you can say to a bunch of guys, look, let's go, let's all in a mob rush down to that church and smash all the statues of Mary. Some people might do it out of general biblical convictions, but let's face it, a lot of guys are just up for, you know, a lot of fighting and smashing, unfortunately, like Millwall football fans, for example. So, in all seriousness, you've got to see the Reformation being picking up on that, and there was and it got out of hand in places as well. So, 1522 to 24, Zwingli writes various disputations, and in his disputation, there's a much sharper accent on the normative action of the Bible as the regulation of life. It's one of his key themes. Zwingli kept going on that life should be regulated according to the Bible, the scriptures. At this point, he also clashes with the Anabaptists. There was a time when he did sort of dally a little bit with infant baptism. He thought maybe we should have believers' baptism. But as we're going to see, that was just a bridge too far. Exactly why he held back, we're not sure. But believers' baptism in the Reformation period had anarchic associations. It was chaos. It was anarchy. In fact, it had the same problem with the Jews. It wasn't just the Anabaptists, Jews, Muslims. It's one of the reasons we are quite harsh, rightly, on some of the nasty things Luther said about Jews. But you need to realise that this is a problem throughout Europe, that how do you cope with groups of people who don't fit into society? If everyone else is being baptised as a baby, that's how your name gets on the state register. But if you're a Jew or an Anabaptist or who don't fit into that, you are, you know, this is anarchy. How does the government control you? There's all those kind of tensions. So you need to understand the things that Luther said about Jews, that this wasn't racial discrimination. I'm not defending it, but it was religious assimilation that he was worried about. In fact, what Luther said about the Jews is what most Europeans would say at his time. He wasn't saying anything particularly new. In fact, to help us think about it, anybody know what the English reformers didn't really say much about the Jews? Anybody know why the English reformers hardly said anything about the Jews?
Kicked them out, illegal 12 and 9.
Yeah, exactly. So if we're going to start pointing fingers at Luther saying nasty things, the only reason why the English reformers didn't say anything is because in 1290, Edward kicked them all out. And when all the Jews were exiled from England, and they weren't allowed back until, well, Oliver Cromwell, after the English Civil War, started to let them back. Okay, so after his disputations, then we have in 1523, he writes his 67 articles, which were adopted by the city of Zurich as the city's official doctrine. And the city experienced rapid reform. Preaching and Bible readings, known as prophesying, we'll think about that at the moment, were becoming more frequent. Images and relics were frowned upon. Clerical marriage was allowed. Monks and nuns were encouraged to work out their isolated existence. Monasteries were dissolved. Their wealth was used to fund education, to care for the poor. And in 1525, Zurich broke from Rome, and the Mass was replaced by the Lord's Supper. And the church Zwingli tried to introduce had church discipline. It wasn't quite as strict as the Anabaptists, but had a kind of a similar emphasis. And so the Swiss Reformation had quite an emphasis on church discipline. As I said, at Zurich, he established what's called the prophesying. So some of you might have heard that in a Puritan context, but as they read 1 Corinthians, and Paul talks about people prophesying, their understanding of this, and let's not get a big debate about exactly what's going on prophesying, but their understanding of prophesying was that it was basically preaching. And it all started with Zwingli. He introduced this training thing. Zwingli really started the reformed view of pastors' training that would happen in reformed churches today. He started it all with this thing called a prophesying. Now, a prophesying is you get a whole lot of ministers and those who are not ministers, but those who think they might be called to preach. You get them together. You get a Bible passage. So, I don't know, Philippians 4. James was preaching on Philippians 4 last week. Philippians 4 is the Bible passage. The least experienced preacher has a go first, and then the next experienced, and then all up until the most experienced. And it's basically just a workshop on preaching, and they're helping one another to be better preachers. And Zwingli started it. He lays the foundation of ministerial training. So, okay, now we're going to come on to the dispute with Luther. So just remind you of some of the background. They are quite different people, but the one similarity is they're both patriotic. So Zwingli's a very patriotic Swissman, his tribal group, language group, and Luther's very patriotically German. But there are great differences. As I've said, Luther was rural, came from a feudal system. He was protected by Frederick the Wise. Zwingli lives in a city. Now, in the cities of Europe, there's very different from the protectorate, etc., electors like Frederick. He lives in a city that has a much more representative form of government. It's not quite democracy like we would know, but it's much more representative. It's a city, which means there's less family ties. It also means it's a more radical place. Cities are always more radical, so ideas spread much more quickly. Another difference is that Zurich, by this point, from 1499 onwards, Zurich is independent of the Holy Roman Empire. So the emperor is not going to be so bothered with what's going on in Switzerland. He is quite bothered about what's going on in Germany, because although Luther's at the end of the empire, he's still in the empire. Again, a difference. Because of that kind of context, Luther never ever met Frederick the Wise. So Frederick the Wise, his sort of elector, is a very influential, powerful man. Luther never met him because he's in a feudal system. Zwingli in Zurich, he would be almost in weekly dialogue with the city council. Zwingli is a great humanist, like Calvin. In fact, pretty much all of the reformers were real fans of humanism, the current sort of thinking from the intellectuals in the universities of their day. Beza, Melanchthon, they were all humanists. Luther wasn't. I suppose the acid test is Erasmus, who translated the New Testament. All the reformers loved Erasmus, apart from Luther despised him. Luther basically said, he gave us the New Testament, that was good, but that's it. He's just a vacillator. Right, so that all background brings us to the main event, which is the Lord's Supper. So this is why Zwingli became quite famous, because he had a big falling out with Luther over the Lord's Supper. So what we're going to do is look at the Marburg Colloquy in 1529, when they had their big debate. And the key thing is not so much to look at who was right and who was wrong, but let's see a sort of trajectory of where their ideas are leading us. And before I go on, I just want to apologize. Last week, I confused things. So I want to say, forget everything I said last week. I confused myself as much as anybody else in the question time. Forget about that. In fact, generally, forget terms like transubstantiation and consubstantiation, because those are terms that we try to put back on the reformers. So that I don't confuse myself, I just want to start with what they actually said in their words. And so the Marburg Colloquy we're going to look at in a moment, that was between Luther and Zwingli, because Calvin is also quite key on this. What I want to do is start by just saying what they said so we're clear, and then we can move on. So, Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, they were all united in their opposition to two things. So they all agreed that they were against one thing that the church did. And that was the sacrifice of the Mass. So they were against the fact that at the Mass, it was any kind of sense of Jesus being sacrificed again. You can still see that today. If you're in a church, maybe a high Anglican or a Catholic church, where the priest turns his back on the congregation and lifts the bread up like that, that is symbolizing a sacrifice. That is, he's being a priest, not in the sense of he's representing God to the people, but in the sense he's representing the people to God. He's literally offering Jesus' body again, like another sacrifice. And that's what all the reformers disagreed with that violently. They said the Mass is not another sacrifice. And the other thing they all disagreed with was at that time, only the clergy drank from the cup. So everybody had the bread, but only the clergy had the cup. The reformers thought that all Christians should eat both the bread and drink from the cup. So they agreed on lots of things. They agreed on how important it was. They agreed on the spiritual presence of Christ. They agreed that it wasn't a sacrifice, but it was commemorating Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. But they did all disagree on three points. And this is where the argument comes. They disagreed, first of all, on the mode of Christ's presence. So they all agreed that Christ was present when we share communion. But was he bodily present in the bread, or was he spiritually present? That's one thing they argued over. They also argued over the organ of receiving Christ's body. So how do you receive his body? That seems a strange thing. But what they meant was, do you receive him with your mouth, or do you receive him by faith? Are you literally eating Christ's body, or are you receiving him by faith? And the other thing they argued about is the extent of reception. That's a slight academic question, but they said, imagine that there are people who are not Christians, non-believers, taking communion. Are they really receiving or not? That was another thing they argued, but that's obviously slightly hypothetical because you don't know whether they're Christians or not. But anyway, those are the three things they disagreed with. So that's the background. What happened? Well, let's take the argument through. Let's begin with Luther. Luther emphasized the spoken word of promise that God became flesh. And it's not a ritual. It's, as we share communion, it's a way to grasp Christ by faith. I don't know if you remember, but he had an argument with Andreas Karlstadt, in the 1520s. And Karlstadt's interpretation of that passage we read earlier was unusual, but not completely unheard of. There were Christians who thought that. And when Karlstadt came to that passage where Jesus says, "This is my body, do this in remembrance of me," what Karlstadt thought was going on was that Jesus was saying, "This is my body, do this in remembrance of me." You see? So the "this is my body," he thought Jesus was pointing at his physical body, but then the "do this in remembrance" was the bread and the wine. Now, Karlstadt thought that, and that was unusual, obviously, because it wasn't the official doctrine, but it wasn't unheard of. The problem was, I don't know if you remember the background, so Karlstadt is starting to say this while Luther is in Wartburg Castle. So if you remember what Ian said about Luther, after the Diet of Worms, he's basically sentenced to death, but he's kidnapped. It's a pretend kidnap. He's in the castle, and while he's in the castle, Karlstadt is in charge of the Reformation in Wittenberg and goes a bit crazy. So he does all sorts of things. Big mistake. He pushes reform way too fast. There's wild, imagine, as I say, gangs of young men going around smashing up all the statues. So they're thinking, great, the Reformation is sort of anarchy. Prophets arrive in Wittenberg claiming you don't need the Bible anymore because God speaks to us directly. They reject infant baptism. They start advocating slaughtering the ungodly. So you literally say to people, repent or die. So it's all going crazy. And Luther comes out of captivity to sort of sort it all out. Now that's really important because you've got to realize, therefore, that now Luther associates a belief in the Lord's Supper as just memorial with anarchy. Do you see that? So he now assumes that if you believe that the Lord's Supper isn't genuinely Christ present, that you're going to become like Karlstadt and all these wild Anabaptists and you're going to be crazy. So that's Luther. Luther's got to a point where anything that even sniffs that you're changing the Lord's Supper, changing the Mass, that's going to lead to anarchy. So he's immediately against it. Zwingli, on the other hand, he goes through a journey himself. So he doesn't deny real presence immediately, but he's moving towards seeing the Lord's Supper as commemoration. He receives a letter from a friend, a guy called Hearn, who points out, which is something that's probably obvious to us, but wasn't then, that the word is could be symbolic. And once Findlay gets that, in his writing, he starts talking about signification a lot, that this signifies something. And he writes to a guy called Alba, attacking real presence. Luther hears about that, he gets very angry, and it was very common in this period, a pamphlet war. So there's no actual fighting, but they write lots of pamphlets, arguing heatedly with one another. So at this point, on the one hand, you've got Luther. He's got about 1,000 years of church history, understanding 1 Corinthians 11 in a particular way. And to him, it seems obvious. But on the other hand, you've got Zwingli, and he's saying, well, is could mean signify. It just means it represents Christ's body. And of course, as we have Mark 14, what do you understand that by that? So for example, if I had a tennis ball in my hand and I said, this is the moon to you, most of you, because of hundreds of years of understanding, we've been to English lessons, we know what a simile is and a metaphor, we instinctively think, well, he doesn't mean it's literally the moon. He's going to tell us some sort of picture of how the planets, using this as if it symbolises the moon. So it's obvious to us, but it wouldn't have been to Luther because they didn't speak in that way as much then. So you can see the tension. It works both ways. And as a result of that, the Lord's Supper splits Luther from Zwingli, just as baptism splits Zwingli from the Anabaptists. So Zwingli was happy to see the Lord's Supper as being symbolic. He wouldn't go the same with baptism. He wouldn't say that it should be believer's baptism. Now, this causes a bit of a problem because at this point, politically, the only hope for the Reformation to fight off the emperor and etc. is for some kind of unity. So you did have this Reformation going on in Germany and in Switzerland. But if they're going to stick to, if there's going to be any hope for the future, how can you get them together? And in 1529, Philip of Hesse comes up with a brilliant idea of forging an alliance with the Luther princes in the north and the reformers in the south. And he realises, though, if that's going to happen, it's only going to happen if he can get Luther and Zwingli to agree on the Lord's Supper. So he calls them to this meeting at a castle in Marburg. And I've got to say, it's one of those events. If you could be anywhere, that would have been fascinating. You've got basically the most brilliant minds of the Reformation all in one place. So on the one hand, you've got Luther with his right-hand man, Philip Melanchthon. On the other side, you've got Zwingli and a guy called Euclion Pardius. What a fantastic name. He was a reformer in Basel, probably the greatest patristic scholar, the early church fathers at that time. And then you've also got Martin Bucer, who was going to be later key to the Reformation in England. And they had a great debate. You might have heard about it. At one point in the meeting, they were round a table, had a sort of a cloth over it. At one point in the meeting, Luther pulled back the cloth, and before they'd met, he'd got a piece of chalk and he'd written in Latin, hoc est corpus meum, this is my body. And all he would do is point at it, this is what Jesus has said. Which is, when I was taught doctrine at LBC, we had a seminar on this. One person had to speak for and against the view of the Lord's Supper. And I got a friend who did the same. So before the seminar started, he just wrote, this is my body on the board. And this is not exaggeration. For about 30 minutes, he wouldn't say anything except, that's what the Bible says. Which didn't really lead to much of a debate. But that's what Zwingli was like. So they argued about it. They kept arguing about it. Martin Bucer was great. He wanted unity. So he was one of those guys, would make a great civil servant. He spent the whole time running between them, saying, oh, we've got an agreement, haven't we really? And ultimately, they agreed on 14 and a half points out of 15. But this was the one. The bit about the Lord's Supper was the one that Luther wouldn't budge on. And Luther, at the end of the meeting, declares that Zwingli is of a different spirit. Now that's his way of saying he doesn't think Zwingli is a Christian. In fact, as I said before, I'm pretty sure that Luther would think that none of us are Christians because we don't have his very high view of the Lord's Supper. Now, after that, German princes, so this alliance all fails. They were hoping for that. The German princes, they were already, without this, forming an alliance with the empire. They form 1530 to 46, when Luther died, what's called the Schmalkaldic League. And that meant that the necessity for an alliance with the Swiss has passed. And that was bad news for Zwingli, because what he didn't realise is failing to make an agreement with Luther, they're on their own in Switzerland now. And the Swiss cantons were plunged into war. And as we heard at the start, Zwingli was killed in Capel. And his work then continued on to his son-in-law, Heinrich Bullinger, who then had a huge impact on the English Reformation. So that's his life. Just to finish up quickly, what can we learn from Zwingli? What's Zwingli's legacies? Four things I think he sort of left to the Reformation. Number one, this would apply to all the reformers, but I think it was really Zwingli's main thing, was the authority of the Bible. We heard how he started his work in Zurich. He genuinely trusted in preaching the word and let God's word do its work. He would patiently let God do its work. Secondly, I think he bequeathed to us the prophesying. So this idea of training ministers. And it wasn't a sort of a in the university high technical sort of thing. It was a very practical. He thought the church should be training all Christians to minister the word. He had a real emphasis on that. Thirdly, the Lord's Supper. So I would say that how you trace, and maybe James is thinking maybe doing this next term, how you trace from the reformers to the Baptist church like now is quite complicated. We don't descend straight from the Anabaptists. It's a bit more complicated than that. But I would argue that Zwingli was kind of one of the forerunners of a lot of Baptist type of thinking. He didn't go all the way to believers' baptism, but that was probably because he was a man of his time and he was so scared of being associated with the Anabaptists. But if you know anything about the Baptist Union, so we have a declaration of principle, which is the basis of the Baptist Union. The first one is that it's about authority. We believe that Jesus rules the church, but the only way you can know how Jesus rules the church is as he's revealed in the Holy Scriptures, and that is the supreme authority for what we believe and how we behave. That's pretty much what the first principle says, and that is exactly what Zwingli believed. I think we probably got that from him. And the fourth area, as we said, was the key thing was, the sovereignty of God. Sovereignty of God was fundamental to Zwingli's thinking. It impacted all of his theology. The life of the church, the teaching of the church, he argued, had lost their centre in God. He said that our theology as a church was supposed to be about God, but it had become really about human beings. And his big thing was, how can we make the way we worship at church be all about God so that it's really to his glory and his glory alone? Of course, that was hard, though. He struggled with lots of things like childbirth. Many of the reformers experienced suffering, children dying. That was a common thing. Modern medicine has probably deadened our awareness to this. If you ever ask that question about when would you write to live in human history, the answer is pretty easy. It's always after 1945, basically after penicillin has been invented and after antibiotics, because you've got people died of blisters before that. And so in this time in particular with the plague, death was really common, so it's something that they were wrestling with all the time. And that, I think, is I've gone long enough. That is Zwingli. So I'm just going to stop there. But does anybody want to ask any questions? I'm not claiming I'll be able to answer.